Mexico when it became clear Americans were traveling there to bring back the drug. Calling the case a personal tragedy for Mr. Udell, White said most people would wrongly equate the strict liability misdemeanor he pleaded guilty to with criminal wrongdoing. Jail time, she added, would unjustifiably and needlessly compound the stigma and punishment for an offense in facts that are without personal wrongdoing. Likewise, Goldenheim, the firm's former chief scientist and medical director, was in agony about the charge, his lawyer said. He'd been labeled a criminal, and that is horrendously harsh punishment for someone who has done so much good, and under the agreed statement of facts has done nothing wrong. Friedman's lawyer pointed out that the company distributed anti-diversion brochures and anti-fraud prescription pads, created a law enforcement liaison unit within Purdue, funded local law enforcement programs, and eventually altered sales rep compensation so the system would not lend itself to abuse. While other Purdue employees made statements about OxyContin that were inconsistent with company policy and that should not have been made, Michael Friedman did not participate in that misconduct. Without proof that he committed a criminal act, to jail him would be virtually unprecedented under American law, his lawyer said. In other words, the lawyers did exactly what Ramseyer predicted they would do in his remarks. They refused to take responsibility for the death and destruction caused by the drug, to the point of reiterating again in court that the enormous benefits of OxyContin far outweigh its risks, even taking into account the grief from those we've heard about today. Calling it unprecedented to hold pharmaceutical corporate officers criminally liable in such a case, Ramseyer noted that Udell, Friedman, and Goldenheim, in accepting the plea, were conceding that they had not been powerless to prevent the crime. As corporate officers, these men had a duty to ensure that misbranding did not occur. He predicted that Purdue's next public relations campaign would begin the moment he sat down from making his remarks. They will attempt to minimize the crimes to which they pled guilty. And while that is exactly what their lawyers did, Ramseyer later said the men seemed distressed throughout the proceedings. They were very unhappy, he told me. We do cases in court where people get sentenced to 20 or 30 years in prison, and they didn't seem as unhappy as those three guys. Ramseyer remained loath to say much more about the case, although the fact that he'd been diagnosed with cancer while working on it and had to take a break midway through the case for treatment seemed to sear it in his mind as both a personal challenge and a professional high mark. He hoped the case had a chilling effect on pharmaceutical companies and overprescribing doctors alike, but he wasn't sure. He'd read recently that enough opioid painkillers had been prescribed in 2010 to medicate every American adult around the clock for a month. And it's worse now, he told me in 2016. The problem was so widespread that Super Bowl ads now targeted relievers of opioid-caused constipation. Purdue had a laxative they marketed too, Ramseyer said, of Senecot. In fact, according to the rep call notes subpoenaed for the case, OxyContin and Senecot were routinely recommended hand in hand. So they got you on both ends, Ramseyer said. Conspicuously absent from the courthouse drama was the family that owned the company and its 214 affiliates worldwide and benefited the most from the drug's sale. Purdue had earned over $2.8 billion from the drug by 2007, including $595 million in earnings in 2006 alone. Unlike a public company that answers to shareholders, privately held Purdue answered only to the Sacklers. In 2015, the family would earn its way onto Forbes' America's Richest Families list. With an estimated net worth of $14 billion, the OxyContin clan would edge out such storied families as the Bushes, Mellons, and Rockefellers. Having gone from selling earwax remover and laxatives to the most lucrative drug in the world, the family had museum wings and college institutes named for it from Boston to Tel Aviv. Mortimer Sackler even had a pink climbing rose named after him, courtesy of his gardener wife. The official description of the flower, the Rosa Mortimer Sackler, reminded her of her husband, she said. The blooms give the impression of delicacy and softness, but are in fact very tough and little affected by bad weather. Mortimer may have inherited his toughness from his older brother, Arthur, who'd put himself and his two brothers through medical school by selling student newspaper ads and delivering flowers sometimes with holes in his shoes. The Don Draper of American pharmaceutical marketing, Arthur pioneered the idea of showering doctors with favors and funding experts to back drug makers' claims in the 1960s. It was his marketing genius that fueled the emergence of pills as a quick fix, his marketing prowess that delivered Valium and Librium, dubbed Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones, to countless nightstands. Realizing the importance of controlling his company's message, Arthur had launched both a medical advertising agency and a medical news magazine before buying Purdue Frederick with his brothers. It was under his direction that preliminary and inevitably flawed scientific studies were first used to buttress the wonders of whatever drug he was hawking. No wonder his brothers thought nothing of excavating the flimsy and outdated letter heralding the less than 1% addiction rate nearly a decade after Arthur's death. What in fact was the addiction rate among those prescribed opioids for chronic malignant pain? More recent studies, not letters to the editor, penned in 1980, put the figure as high as 56%. At the time of his death in 1987, Arthur was lionized for his entrepreneurial vision and boundless obsession for collecting things, especially art. He once talked the Met into letting him reimburse the museum for four major works that the museum already owned, just so he could have them displayed with his name as the donor. Still, he had not been fully embraced by the Upper East Side society to which he aspired, not until his memorial service held at the storied Temple of Dendur inside the Met Sackler wing, at which New York Mayor Ed Koch remarked, "I don't know why, but Jews aren't buried in synagogues." Well, Arthur built his own temple. Arthur Sackler hated not just bad press, but any press that was not of his own directing, a Vanity Fair writer observed shortly after his death. As obsessive about secrecy as he was about money-making and art, he would have abhorred everything about the Abingdon hearing. At the courthouse, testifying before the judge, the relatives of the dead argued repeatedly for jail time, as did Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group that vented, "Why have three wealthy Purdue executives who have pleaded guilty to orchestrating this dangerous promotional campaign escaped jail time? And why are they paying merely $34.5 million in penalties?" Even a fellow prosecutor in Brownlee's office felt Purdue's punishment was too light. He said, "The dividends may go slightly down, but nobody cares because nobody who made the product goes to jail. If the government were serious, they'd put people in jail and others would be fearful," said Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrew Basford, who would spend most of the next decade prosecuting heroin dealers as a direct consequence of the OxyContin epidemic down the hall from the office where Brownlee worked. "But you can't put a corporation in jail. You just take their money, and it's not really their money anyway. The corporation feels no pain," he said. Van Zee and Sister Beth viewed the settlement with both satisfaction and regret. Though the executives were placed on probation for 3 years in order to perform 400 hours of community service in a drug abuse or drug treatment program, Van Zee and Sister Beth were furious that the Purdue fine would not be allocated to provide drug treatment in the medically underserved region. "This little county was left with nothing, even though we've been disproportionately impacted by the drug," Sister Beth said. The $634.5 million fine was instead divided among law enforcement, state and federal Medicaid programs to reimburse it for claims resulting from the misbranding, to create Virginia's prescription monitoring program, and to settle $130 million in civil claims. The only thing the Lee County Sheriff's Office got from Purdue was placebo OxyContin pills for use in drug stings. Many anti-opioid activists were mad, too, that technically it was Purdue Frederick, Purdue Pharma's holding company, that was banned from participating in the federal insurance programs Medicaid, Medicare, and TRICARE as part of its 5-year probation, rather than Purdue Pharma itself, which was still permitted to participate and therefore to continue selling OxyContin. "They are independent associated companies," a spokesman explained. The executives were likewise banned from doing business with federal health programs, a decision they repeatedly appealed in intervening years and lost, leading one federal district judge to scold, "Plaintiffs appear to misunderstand or misstate the basic elements of their conviction." It's very typical for these companies to have an entity that is a shell company, basically, set up to plead guilty to the crime, rather than the actual corporate entity taking the fall, Barry Meyer said. Flanked by state and federal flags, Judge Jones admitted that the lack of jail time frustrated him. But the Abingdon federal judge's hands were tied by the plea agreement struck between Purdue and the prosecutors, he said. He would have preferred that parts of the fine be funneled into treatment, adding that prosecutors were reluctant to direct treatment funds in a manner beyond their expertise and possibly contrary to national policy. Asked nearly a decade later about the aftermath of the Purdue Pharma settlement on the communities his court covers, Judge Jones told me, "Opioid addiction continues to be, frankly, a terrible concern. It's rare that I don't have a case today involving substance abuse." He declined to divulge the details of the executive's probation, citing privacy concerns, other than to say they completed it to his satisfaction in their home state of Connecticut. When Howard Udell died unexpectedly of a stroke in 2013 at the age of 72, a local newspaper heralded him for having turned his community service into a redemptive experience. After counseling veterans at a Veterans Administration hospital on job skills, Udell went on to found the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, helping hundreds of veterans navigate problems including evictions, dishonorable discharges, and substance abuse-related crimes. Even after his community service hours were completed, Udell stayed on to assist the legal center. "It was very unpleasant for Howard, who was scrupulously honest and careful, but we endeavored to make the most of it," said Friedman, who also performed his community service at the site, according to the newspaper, which described the executive's initial service there, euphemistically, as volunteer. "A lesser person would have crawled into the basement," said Udell's son, Jeffrey, himself a former federal prosecutor. His dad's fingerprinting at the guilty plea, his 3 years of supervised release, the fact that Udell had to check in with his probation officer before he visited his grandchildren across state lines. The younger Udell was still incensed that his late father had been forced to endure such indignities. He pointed out repeatedly in an hour-long phone call that the government presented zero proof of his father's wrongdoing. The idea that someone of his caliber and his integrity could have the ignominy of a federal crime is so outrageous and unjust, said Jeffrey Udell, describing his dad as a humanitarian and a law and order saint, the kind of restaurant patron who would correct a waiter when presented with a mistakenly small bill. "I know there are unfortunately some very sad and unfortunate people who are parents of kids who abuse drugs and overdose. I feel horrible for those people, as my father did, and for the loss they've suffered." But again, he insisted, Team Brownlee presented no evidence that Howard Udell had any knowledge of what was happening in the company some 25 levels below him amid a sales hierarchy that was not remotely within his purview, Udell said. Jones said the case was not only the largest he'd ever presided over in terms of the fine, but also the most dramatic. "There was a hard rain that day," he recalled, "and yet there were so many people in attendance that the court set up a separate overflow room for observers to watch via video." Nor would he ever forget the most heart-wrenching portion of the parent testimony, that of Fishtown native Lee Nuss, who described how her only son, Randy, died as he was getting ready to leave for culinary school in 2003. "His prepaid college ended up paying for his funeral," Nuss said. Nuss had begged the judge to reject the terms of the plea agreement, imploring him, "Money means nothing to them. Let the punishment fit the crime." Then she brandished the tiny brass urn she carried wherever she traveled, the one Purdue lawyers had gotten ejected from Karen White's whistleblower trial. Randy had begun as dust in her belief, and unto dust he had prematurely returned. She clutched his ashes as she stepped down from the stand. "This is from your drug, OxyContin." "And here he is in this courtroom," Nuss said, staring steely-eyed at Udell, Friedman, and Goldenheim. A reporter sitting in the courtroom thought for a moment she was going to throw the urn at the men, but Nuss waved it instead and returned to her seat. She had wanted the men to apologize, to admit that they had understood all along that OxyContin wasn't a novel way of finding pain, but simply a different and more potent way of dispensing nature's oldest drug. If the Sackler's lieutenants had legitimately not known about the flood of pills unleashed by sales reps toting around bad data and free shrubbery 25 rungs down the corporate ladder from them, maybe it was because they had not cared to look. Part 2. Objects in Mirror Are Closer Than They Appear. Chapter 5. Suburban Sprawl. Awareness of the opioid crisis has typically come in waves, often celebrity-studded and well-covered by the media. The death by overdose of Philip Seymour Hoffman in 2014, then 2 years later, the death of Prince. But for ordinary citizens, the news that opioids had crossed over from not me and not anyone I know to mainstream traveled more slowly, in dribs and drabs. Maybe when the Cincinnati Inquirer became the first newspaper in the country to dedicate a reporter solely to the heroin beat. 4 hours east of Lee County, in a southern city that counts the local TV weatherman among its biggest celebrities, the February 2006 news that meteorologists Jamie Singleton and Mark Lamar had been shooting up heroin stunned viewers of the NBC affiliate station in Roanoke, where I live. The story broke after Lamar suffered a near-fatal overdose at a party, an event that drew local police and eventually the attention of federal authorities. Viewers loved watching them both, especially the stylish tan Lamar, poised and confident, his hands gesturing fluidly in front of the weather map's green screen. Back then, it was still hard to picture a 36-year-old collapsed on an apartment floor in an affluent Roanoke suburb. Harder still to imagine a world where educated, well-paid white guys felt the need to disappear into bathrooms at parties, or worse, as in Lamar's case, end up being tossed into a bathtub and doused with cold water and ice in the hope of waking him up. The weathermen were skin-popping, recalled Police Chief Chris Perkins, then an undercover Roanoke detective. The term referred to the practice of injecting the heroin under the skin rather than directly into a vein for a milder high, the idea being that skin popping gave you a better high than snorting heroin, but wasn't as potent or dangerous as intravenously injecting it. But the weathermen soon were outed, as most users are, the sweat circles under the guy's sport coats, the first in a progressively sad series of giveaways. They'd been running around in 80-degree weather in long sleeves, Perkins said. Young people were already starting to snort heroin, but then when the weathermen made the news, it started to become almost vogue, this notion that you could inject heroin and somehow still be functional, he added. Perkins was working the city's drug unit when the overdose call came in. He remembered finding Lamar unconscious in the bathroom of his well-appointed apartment before rescue squad workers arrived. Lamar survived barely, moving away from the region soon after. Friends of overdosing users commonly chuck them into the bathtub and try to revive them with ice or cold water to avoid having to call 911, which could draw police to the scene, along with criminal charges. One police officer I know showed up to an overdose call to find an unconscious man on the floor, a frozen fish on his neck, a frozen bottle of soda shoved into his pants, ice all over the floor, and the user's friends long gone from the scene. In a region of just over a quarter million people, a blue dot Democratic stronghold in the center of a hilly rural red, Roanoke is a smallish city, transformed in the mid-1880s into a gritty railroad town and now more than a century later, striving to become a healthcare, neuroscience, and medical research hub. We're really going from train city to brain city, a city manager recently enthused. But Roanoke retains its safe, small-town feel with an almost Mayberry level of friendliness. Shortly after I moved here in 1989, a grocery store clerk picked up my bag of shiitakes and cheerfully wanted to know, "Lordy, what are you fixing with these?" A neighbor and journalist friend who spent the bulk of her career in Philadelphia still chuckles when I lock my doors. She used to lock her doors in Philly, but here in Roanoke, she travels for days at a time and leaves her house wide open. The opioid epidemic is an urban story, a suburban story, and a rural story, said Dr. Jennifer Wells, a Roanoke addiction specialist who has patients from each of these demographics, including one mom with 5 kids in a countryside trailer and no running water who somehow manages to make it to her group therapy meetings every week. Roanoke is just big enough where all the stories meet, Wells said. The skin-popping weatherman represented Roanoke's first wake-up call, but it was wrongly viewed by myself and other area journalists as an anomaly. The story was so tawdry that the Roanoke Times assigned 2 beat reporters to track it, one from courts and the other from media and entertainment. It received much more attention, for instance, than the national story that broke in our backyard when Purdue Pharma settled with the feds a year later. Before the Weatherman incident, heroin had been the domain of police and court reporters in Roanoke, widely believed to be an inner-city, read black, drug. In the 80s and 90s, maybe a few dozen people were doing heroin here, said Don Waltice, the assistant U.S. attorney who became one of the federal government's top heroin prosecutors in the state's western half. Because heroin is a depressant, people kind of withdraw, he said. They go in a corner, shoot up, and sit there in the dark in a fetal position. They weren't out there committing crimes like with crack or meth. It was a largely invisible and isolated group. It was common knowledge back then, among the handful of mostly African-American heroin users and dealers in Roanoke, that you don't sell heroin to white people because they'll turn you in, as Waltice put it. In the mid-2000s, it was also common knowledge that the stronger and more dangerous the heroin, the more users yearned to have it, as Roanoke addiction researcher Warren Bickle, then working in Baltimore, described it. "Heron is my girlfriend," one of his patients told him, adopting the street pronunciation for the drug popular among African-American users. He'd come to Bickle's lab with track marks on his neck. All his other veins were spent. And what this patient wanted Bickle to know was no different than what the Lee County farmer meant when he told his doctor how OxyContin had stolen everything from him. Nothing's more powerful than the morphine molecule. And once it has its hooks in you, nothing matters more. Not love, not family, not sex, not shelter. The only relationship that matters is between you and the drug. Bickle went on to scientifically quantify the indifference of the typical opioid user, comparing the average non-addicted person's perception of the future, calculated to be 4.7 years, against an addicted user's idea of the future, which is just 9 days. The first time I interviewed him in 2016, Bickle said he hoped to design treatment methods that would not only predict future addictive behavior among children, but might also help those at risk of becoming addicted improve and extend their temporal views, therefore arming themselves against the scourge. Though he'd won prestigious grants and awards for his groundbreaking work, he was often touted as a star of the growing Brain City constellation. I struggled to understand how Bickle's research applied to the real-life heroin users I knew, some of whom were now trading sex for drug money a few blocks from his office. Could a Bickle-designed app have prevented Jesse Balstridge's death? Where was the hope? When I asked him those questions, he pointed to a framed Chinese proverb that he takes inspiration from. It is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. But the larger question about hope continued to reverberate wherever I went. I heard a version of it from an overwhelmed family friend who pulled me aside at a wedding party to tell me about her 34-year-old addicted daughter and pleaded with me through tears. "Just tell me one thing. What can your book do to help me keep my daughter alive?" My friend was discovering the same thing through experience that I was through my interviews, that the legal and medical structures meant to combat Americans' heroin epidemic were woefully disconnected, often at odds with one another, and full of unintended consequences. A crack-turned-heroin dealer with Philadelphia roots landed in Roanoke in 2006, the same time the weathermen began sweating through their long-sleeved shirts. Clifton Light Lee made heroin an equal opportunity drug, connecting with drug users black and white and figuring, correctly, that he could easily double his profit margin if he imported the drug to comparatively staid Roanoke rather than continue selling it solely in New Jersey and New York. When police caught two suburban teenagers middlemanning for Lee, selling heroin to their friends and keeping some for their own use, they were stunned by what their cell phones revealed. Evidence implicating 50 other kids they'd been selling heroin to. Most attended Hidden Valley High School, an outlying Roanoke County's wealthiest neighborhood, home to insurance agents and doctors and lawyers. Lee was the guy willing to get the kids involved, Waltice said, pulling out a handwritten organizational chart he'd put together to help him keep visual track. At the top of the pyramid were the non-users like Lee, who were in it just for the money, and at the bottom were the addicted, including some whose names were crossed out, dead of overdose. By the time Lee was sentenced to 11 years in prison in 2008, prosecutors had pinned him with bringing 1,000 bags of heroin into the region 2 to 3 times a week, paying $5,000 for 20 bricks of heroin that his network then sold for $30,000. The growth in heroin users was as exponential as its 600% profit margin. The first bags sold in Roanoke were stamped with the names Funeral and Green Frog, and some had a purity of 90%, a concentration that addicted users quickly and made the dosages deadlier. I can remember lying in bed awake at night thinking, how far is this thing going to go, Waltice said. If you have a guy doing a chain of bank robberies, you catch him and then the robberies stop. But the problem with heroin is the lure of the morphine molecule. Heron is my girlfriend. Even as Waltice locked up the perpetrators, he suspected that the demand for heroin was already too entrenched. There were still plenty of user sellers eager to get on the nearest heroin highway to fetch a new batch from Baltimore or Richmond or Paterson, New Jersey. Unlike Ronnie Jones and Clifton Lee, they didn't aspire to get rich stealing dope. They just wanted to keep from getting dope sick. The story of Clifton Lee and the addicts he serviced and created didn't trickle down to me at the newspaper, where I wrote about family issues until 2010. That year, the region's only heroin overdose death made headlines, not because it was unique, but because it involved the 21-year-old son of a prominent white businesswoman. No one was paying attention to heroin arrests when they only concerned the children of inner-city black families. A 2009 Roanoke Times story suggesting that heroin was now closing in on the illicit use of OxyContin and prescribed fentanyl patches in popularity seemed to draw shrugs, even as one prosecutor publicly warned, they're skipping over pot and going straight to heroin. Waltice may have been lying in bed, worrying about Spencer Mumpower's role in his classmate Scott Roth's death, but no one, not even the do-gooders giving drug prevention lectures in local high schools, talked about the kids left behind who were still using. It was as if heroin had settled peaceably into Hidden Valley with its manicured lawns and attached multiple car garages, and Scott and Spencer were the only two exposed. Hidden Valley was the perfect name. Scott Roth bought the heroin that ended his life in an apartment in Roanoke's Grandin Village, a retail hub 15 minutes from the Hidden Valley split level where he was raised. A neighborhood where locals dine on regionally sourced produce, take yoga classes, watch subtitled movies, spend thousands on stickly sofas, and crowd the weekly farmer's market, the village is full of tree-lined streets and solid 1920s-era brick homes with expansive carports. As Spencer Mumpower prepared for prison for handing Scott Roth the heroin that resulted in his life-ending overdose, I spent the summer of 2012 trying to make sense of how two young men with educated, caring mothers and movie star good looks could keep the severity of their drug habits hidden for so long. I wanted to alert readers to the growing scourge of heroin in our community, and with two teenage sons still at home, I hoped to inoculate my own family too. After all, information is power, I told myself. I talked to my older son about heroin so much that one of the last things he said to me when we dropped him off at college that fall was, I know, don't do heroin. He rolled his eyes with an annoyance reserved for the exceedingly daft. In the photo Robin Roth chose for her only child's obituary, Scott Roth looked like one of the Backstreet Boys. Blonde and breezy, he called his mom Rob, and wore Madras shorts and Izod shirts. He went by the nickname Vanilla Rice from a cooking job he had at a Japanese steakhouse where he stunt-cooked tableside, juggling knives and shrimp rapping as he chopped. He was a likable young man, polite to strangers, nice to a single mom. He loved the sunflowers she grew on their spacious lawn. She was only mildly annoyed when he invited his friends home to cook for them, using up all the food she'd bought to last them the week. He'd been using drugs off and on roughly since the age of 17 in 2006. The first time he came home clearly impaired, his mom decided to respond boldly. A registered nurse, she wanted to scare him a little, so rather than give him a take-home drug test from CVS, she took him to the emergency room. Her plan backfired when the emergency room doctor returned with Scott's test results. "It's only marijuana, Mrs. Roth," he said, a response that still sends her into a fury. It was all the ammunition Scott needed over the course of his remaining short life to dismiss his mom's warnings. "Lighten up, Rob," he told her. But there was reason for Robin's concern. Later, Scott admitted that he'd smoked his first heroin in 2006, around the time the news broke about the skin-popping weathermen. He was at a high school party when somebody handed him a joint laced with heroin, and the high was so soothing, so enveloping, that he realized right away that this was something special, something new. "You think of heroin as seedy street slums, but that's not at all how it started," Robin told me. About a year after their ER visit, she found a needle and a syringe in Scott's room, and figuring he was already in too deep, she left them there. Afraid he'd resort to sharing needles, she put him in rehab instead. She tried everything she could think of to help her son, from attending Families Anonymous 12-step meetings for relatives of people suffering from addiction to driving him to weekly drug tests at a doctor's office. She took away his car after an alcohol-fueled fender bender in her driveway, and after he turned 18, she kicked him out of the house whenever she found him drinking or doing drugs. She had every door inside her house removed, including the ones to the bathrooms, so he could not hide his drug use inside her home. When I met her 2 years after her son's death, she still had not gotten around to putting the doors back on. Racked with guilt and grief, she could no longer work. At Scott's funeral mass, friends had arrived with sunflowers, his favorite, placing them on the altar. Robin dried the flowers and saved the seeds, and though she was too depressed to plant them the next year, a neighbor tilled up a garden plot in her side yard the following spring. There she planted sunflowers by the hundreds. They grew so tall that they dwarfed her when she stood among them. It became her favorite place, her favorite thing to do, standing in the sunflower grove, listening to the wind chimes on a nearby apple tree that Scott had planted for her one long ago Mother's Day. She felt closest to him there, especially when the wind whipped down Sugarloaf Mountain and through her subdivision, the chimes banging out their bittersweet tunes. That summer, Robin brought a cardboard box full of sunflower seeds for me to our first interview, wrapped up in a bow. Sunflowers were her touchstone, not unlike the 55 on Jesse Bulstridge's football jersey. She texted me pictures of them repeatedly, along with snapshots of her very happy and very silly, knife-wielding Vanilla Rice. She shared her favorite ever picture of a 10-year-old Scotty, the classic headless at the beach trip, where he's buried in sand up to his neck. In Roanoke, 2012 was the tail end of the epidemic's stealth phase. 2 hours up Interstate 81 in the rolling farm country of the northern Shenandoah Valley, the epidemic was now rearing its head too, though mostly still in pill form, and the news of its presence was even slower to emerge. Jesse Bulstridge was now in high school and trading his ADHD medication Adderall to classmates who liked the way it allowed them to drink all night without passing out. In exchange, they plied him with painkillers either bought on the black market or pilfered from their parents' or grandparents' medicine cabinets. Like most parents of the addicted, Christy Fernandez can't pinpoint the moment when her son's life became hostage to prescription pills. It was sometime after Jesse was diagnosed with Lyme meningitis at 15, sometime in between the half-dozen high school football and snowboarding injuries that landed him in doctor's offices and emergency rooms, where he was prescribed opioid painkillers, including oxycodone, Vicodin, and Percocet 30s, as he later referred to the 30-milligram pills, his drug of choice. The boy had so many rounds of stitches, so many concussions and broken bones from playing football, I lost track, Christie said. By his junior year, Jesse had sustained so many concussions that a neurologist told her he'd have to quit football if he got injured again. What Christie didn't understand then was how much the drugs calmed him, dulled the purr of his motor, made him feel normal, as he would later confide. She didn't know then either that Jesse and his friends were trading the bought and stolen pills around widely at so-called farm parties. Christie remembers the first time someone in town suggested her son had a pill problem. Jesse had spent the night at a friend's, and the friend's mother called to accuse him of stealing Percocet from her bathroom cabinet. Christie defended her son, even suggesting that it had been the woman's son, not Jesse, who swiped the pills. The manager of a temp agency, Christie is a businesswoman. Civic-minded, she has always followed the news about the nearby towns Strasbourg and Woodstock. But the only 2010 stories that would have been of relevance to her son's story had been occluded by bigger headline-making news. The attempted bank robbery by a local young man, someone she didn't then know. One among a small but growing group of area heroin users, Brandon Perullo had become so desperate in his dope sickness that he tried to rob a bank, donning a bandana and a black hoodie. He entered the bank twice before demanding cash by handing the teller a threatening note, but his jittery demeanor had already given him away. Brandon was arrested, unarmed, as he exited the building with $1,860 in cash. At his February 2011 sentencing hearing, the 27-year-old described the growing problem in the region, offering to tell his story to teenagers to warn them away from the drug. "No mistake is too big that I can't bounce back from," Brandon told the judge, who sentenced him to 3.5 years in prison. In a quaint town full of historical markers and pricey antiques, the bank robbery in Woodstock made headlines across the Shenandoah Valley. Brandon's mother, Laura Haddon, begged the local newspaper to write about the growing heroin scourge. Her son wasn't the only one buying pills and heroin from mules and commuter dealers driving to Baltimore, she told an editor. "But they blew me off. It was more interesting to write about my son being arrested for robbing a bank," she said. Just before Brandon left for prison in 2011, the local sheriff teamed with school prevention workers to hold the first community-wide meeting about opioid addiction. Stigma was the real enemy of hope for the drug addicted, Haddon decided. So to tamp it down, she decided her job was to explain the misunderstood science of addiction. "Once a person becomes addicted," she said, "he loses his power of choice. His free will becomes hijacked along with the opioid receptors in his brain. When a person's natural opioids are shut down by the deluge of synthetic ones," she told the audience at the community meeting, "it creates a growing tolerance to the drug, making the brain crave ever larger quantities of opioids just to keep from being violently ill." Haddon asked the parents to imagine this. You haven't been able to eat for 3 days and you're starving. Then someone shoves a plate of delicious food in front of you and leaves you alone with it, but it's strictly off limits. Because of the urge to quell that insatiable hunger, she told them, young people in their midst were now driving up to Baltimore, bringing the heroin back here, and selling it like crazy, she said. People you don't even think would be using heroin are using it. But Haddon's lesson about dopamine-overloaded neurons and Baltimore drug deals fell on the deaf ears of the select attendees. No one wants to believe that heroin will ever touch the veins of their children. "Maybe 10 people showed up, and no one asked me a single question," she recalled. "The response was a joke." Years later, not long after her son was released from prison, Haddon began a second, more urgent round of drug prevention advocacy. Soon after Brandon got out, he moved to New York to live near his father and his tight-knit extended Italian family because it was almost impossible to get hired anywhere around Woodstock with a felony record. Brandon was doing well at first, working for his dad and teaching bodybuilding on the side. But 7 months after his release from prison, he relapsed. His family encouraged him to seek treatment, Haddon said, but it was as if some remote dictator had claimed eminent domain on his brain. He died 2 weeks later from an overdose of cocaine and heroin. His mother believes her son died by suicide, driven by his outsized fear of becoming dope sick. "I wonder, to this day, whether he just couldn't do it anymore," she told me. 2 days before his death, Brandon posted on Facebook, "I hope people remember all the good I've done." Christy had not been among those Brandon's mom tried to warn in 2011. If Jesse had any problem at all, she told herself, it had to do with pills, not heroin. But over the next year, her own mother's wedding ring would turn up missing, along with some cash and more pills. And Christy could deny the severity of her son's addiction no longer. Her husband, Jesse's stepdad, insisted she install a lock on their bedroom door. And though she still feels guilty about it, she did. In 2012, there weren't yet Facebook groups to connect the suffering parents in different parts of the state, to share tips about rehab and coping strategies, or to offer physical and monetary support. Back then, Robin Roth felt as if she walked around Roanoke with a giant F on her forehead, branded as a parenting failure. She suffered in silence and anger, much of it directed toward the young man she held responsible for the death of her only child. At Spencer Mumpower's 2012 federal court sentencing, Robin carried a framed portrait of Scott to the witness stand. She looked directly at Spencer, his dark mass of curly hair, now neatly shorn, and leveled a litany of questions designed to make him understand the pain his actions had caused. "Spencer, will you be there to visit me when I'm old and lonely?" "Neither will Scott." "Spencer, will you be there to eat dinner with me, mow my lawn, and wish me a happy birthday?" "Neither will Scott." "Spencer, will you be there to hold my hand when I'm sick and dying?" "Neither will Scott." Her anger was so palpable that U.S. District Court Judge James Turk, an affable octogenarian who shook every defendant's hand and brought his dachshund mix baby girl to court, encouraged her to meet with Spencer before he left for prison. Turk had already sentenced the dealer who supplied the drugs to 20 years. Spencer had played middleman in the deal, pleading guilty and helping prosecutors nab his roommate dealer in exchange for a lighter 8-year sentence. "I think it would help you," Turk told Robin gently from the bench as Spencer sat. But Robin declined, saying she wasn't ready. In the summer of 2012, I followed Robin and Spencer as Spencer prepared for prison. I gave Spencer rides to karate classes, recording our conversations with his permission as I drove. At a KFC lunch buffet, I watched him cheerfully demonstrate a recipe he'd picked up during his earlier jail stint on state charges, blending packets of ketchup, Tabasco, and barbecue sauce. I sat near his relatives as he graduated from drug court, looking childlike in his too big suit. I spent a Saturday with him while he volunteered his time teaching first-time teenage drug offenders and their worried parents, who leaned in intently, trying to divine where Spencer's parents had gone wrong. I found it impossible not to like the kid, honestly. I could ask him anything my mind conjured up, and he would answer me warmly and enthusiastically. He seemed more concerned about being honest than trying to control the narrative. In a freewheeling talk full of advice and drug detecting techniques that was half scared straight and half American gangster, Spencer had parents alternately laughing, wincing, and crying as he displayed the needle mark scars on his arms and the teeth once ruined by amphetamines, now restored by 40 hours of dental work. He showed off his jailhouse tattoos, fashioned by burning Vaseline mixed with BO5 shampoo and a contraband staple, though he'd since had those neatened up too. He discussed the dangers of black market Adderall, an ADHD medicine and amphetamine he once took hourly for 8 days straight. He recited a list of places where he'd hidden his stash as a teenager, inside computers, emptied Sharpie markers and socks, and in the pockets of gym shorts he secretly wore underneath his jeans. "My mom made me empty the pockets of my jeans, but she didn't know about the shorts," he said. He shared tips that, in my view, remain among the best prevention advice I've seen dispensed to parents of at-risk teens. "Rid your medicine cabinets of anything that has codeine, indicative of morphine components, in the name. Set rules and hold kids accountable when they break them, even if it means they go to jail." "The problem with me was the trouble had to outweigh the fun," he said. Though his mother, Ginger Mumpower, had sent him to 15 different rehab facilities, for 8 years, Spencer managed to use and sell drugs before his name ever entered a police blotter. He described what led to his decision to quit selling drugs after being targeted by local police in a catch-and-release drug bust in 2009. Hoping to convert him into a confidential informant, police had taken his drugs and told him, "We're going to wait for you to mess up again so we can catch you again and get you for more things," Spencer recounted, an oversimplification that police only partially confirmed. The threat was enough to make him give up dealing, but in a case of warped reasoning, he believed he could still keep using heroin without getting caught. He allowed his dealer to live with him in exchange for drugs. When Scott Roth showed up at Spencer's apartment to buy heroin, the two hadn't seen each other since high school at Hidden Valley, some 3 years before. They were never best friends, just drug buddies who hung out in the basement of the home of a fellow partier whose dad gave them space to get high and routinely shot up heroin in front of them, according to both Spencer and Robin Roth. Spencer played go-between in the deal, a move that resulted in death by overdose for Scott in April 2010 and prison for Spencer and his roommate dealer. When Scott showed up on his doorstep that night, Spencer was already a full-blown heroin junkie. In his jailhouse mugshot, his eyes are bruised and sunken, and there are chicken pox-like scabs on his face from the itch of amphetamines, to which he was also addicted. He weighed 135 pounds. "One day in jail, I realized I could touch these two fingers around my forearm," he told me, making a C out of his thumb and middle finger. It meant I was a junkie. When fellow inmates teased him about how skinny he was, he started lifting weights in his cell. He fashioned them out of trash bags he filled with water, tying them with bedsheets ripped into strips. He used the money his mom put on his jail commissary account to amass multiple cartons of milk to help build up his muscles by trading ramen noodles and bags of coffee for his cellmate's quarts of milk. For 11 months, his mother refused to bail him out, and even though she knew that jails and prisons could be rife with drugs, she also believed that jail was her best chance for keeping Spencer alive while he awaited federal sentencing. She encouraged church friends and relatives to write to him. His sister Paris, an art student, mailed poems and drawings. Ginger sent him inspirational song lyrics, copies of pages she'd marked from the Bible, and the purpose-driven life. His lawyer, Tony Anderson, recalled his transformation. After 6 months of begging for his mother to bail him out, he finally hit bottom and accepted he had nowhere to go but up. Spencer soon realized, "I like being clean, I like being sober, I like being able to talk to my mother and she talks to me, and I get what's going on here." As his counselor, Vinnie Dabney, remembered it, 15 rehabs had not convinced Spencer that it was not in his best interest to get high. It took time in jail and a friend dying before he could decide he wanted to change. In our interviews, Spencer was alternately immature and wise. His goal, he told me, was to get in shape physically and mentally, to earn some karma before he went away to federal prison. "God knows I've got a lot I need to build back up," he said. He was happy to school me on drug culture, how he'd once saved his lunch money to buy weed and cocaine, the way he extracted the gel out of a fentanyl pain patch and smoked it, where the best places in town were to find drug dealers, loitering outside Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And driving by a diabetes supply pharmacy, he recalled once buying OxyContin off a pharmacy delivery driver. The driver was eventually arrested, but somehow he had another 600 or 700 pills the next day, Spencer said. "That's a shitload of dope." We talked about his drug counselor, Dabney, who years before had been a mostly functioning heroin user for 3 decades, snorting a much less potent form. "It's hard to explain, but some people can manage it," Spencer said. "Like if I knew that none was going to be until Friday and it's Tuesday and I normally do 10 bags a day, but I only have 30 left, I would do the math and make sure I had enough to last till Sunday, because you'll do anything to make sure you're not dope sick." He even offered parenting advice for one of my friends, whose son had already been busted for smoking weed. Once in a northern city where it was deemed a misdemeanor, and once on a Blue Ridge Parkway overlook where it was on federal property and therefore a federal offense, Spencer said. "When he's 18, tell him to move to a state where marijuana is legal. Until then, tell him he'd better start lifting weights because he's not going to do well in jail. Scare the hell out of him if you can. But honestly, there's only a small percentage of kids you can get through to. When I was at that age, I didn't want to hear it either." Spencer was making amends to his mother, apologizing almost daily for the hell he'd put her through, and helping with her latest jewelry store opening. As she recalled committing him to a psychiatric facility after he'd busted himself out of a Christian rehab in West Virginia, Spencer immediately stood up and walked over to hug her for maybe the fourth time that day. "I'm sorry," he said. "I know," she said. With his mom's help, he drafted a letter of apology to Robin Roth and mailed it to her therapist, who would decide when she was strong enough to read it. In it, Spencer offered, when he got out of prison, he would mow her grass. From his prison cell, he would even donate to her the inheritance he received following his grandmother's death. All told, Spencer had already lost 12 friends from Hidden Valley to drug-involved deaths, and every dealer he knew was either dead now or in jail, and he would soon lose several more. He was hale and hearty by the time his mother drove him to a minimum-security federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia, in August 2012. Drug-free for more than 2 years, Spencer admitted that he'd replaced his opioid addiction with Kenpo karate, taking classes almost daily and learning breathing techniques to deal with the anxiety of going to prison. His karate instructor, Rick Perez, had become a father figure to him. Spencer was estranged off and on from his own dad. Perez taught Spencer exercises he could practice in his cell, like slow foot taps that progress up a cinder block wall. Being fit brought Spencer a feeling of confidence as he left for prison, where he hoped to finish his bachelor's degree. After his release, he planned to dedicate himself to helping young people with addiction in memory of Scott Roth. "I called Robin the day Spencer's mom helped him report to prison. She said knowing that Spencer was behind bars again brought her no comfort. I heard as much today as the day my son died," she said, choking up. "I pray for Spencer every day, that he'll be strong. My heart's breaking for that kid, but it's the only shot he has at a normal life to get some accountability." As the months wore on, Robin began to soften toward Spencer. That fall, she started spending her Friday nights with troubled teenagers and their worried parents, in a setting similar to the court-ordered Saturday sessions where Spencer had spoken. She was learning that in her loss, she was far from alone. She and Ginger both were beginning to see that all the sunflowers and speeches in the world would not slow the epidemic spread. Ginger, a minor celebrity in town from her own ads for her business, as well as from a failed campaign for state delegate, was recognized as a friendly face. At her new Ginger's jewelry store, a day rarely passed when someone didn't show up at her counter wanting advice on something other than gold. Distraught parents might pretend to shop for a few minutes, but before long, they'd mention the newspaper articles, and the tear-filled stories would tumble out. A pastor's wife with two addicted sons drove from 2 hours away to search her out. A 63-year-old nurse was struggling to take care of her infant grandson because her 25-year-old heroin-addicted daughter could not. While Ronnie Jones was establishing his clientele in the northern Shenandoah Valley, young people in Roanoke were driving right past Woodstock on their way to Baltimore, Philadelphia, or Newark, or taking the Chinatown bus to New York, where they could pay $100 for 50 bags of heroin stamped with names like Blue Magic or Gucci, then resell them in Roanoke for 6 to 8 times their investment. A drug use survey of Roanoke area high school students bore out the trend. In the fall of 2012, 6.4% reported using heroin one or more times, and almost 10% said they'd tried illicit prescription drugs. A local prevention counselor warned that the two percentages were in the process of flipping because heroin was becoming so much cheaper and easier to get. The family's anonymous meetings in town were filling up. 6 years had passed since the weatherman's final forecast, and the storm had settled in. While Robin Roth searched for solace in sunflowers, and Ginger Mumpower relaxed for the first time in years, knowing that in prison, at least, her son would likely not die of a drug overdose, parents up and down America's heroin highways struggled to find the right culprit or set of culprits to blame. But mostly they kept quiet about it, shut down in their grief and their shame. Chapter 6. Like Shooting Jesus. An hour south of Roanoke, in a part of the state once dominated by unfettered industry, Martinsville, Virginia was stuck in an economic morass. In 2012, the small city of 13,000 laid claim to having the highest unemployment rate in Virginia for 12 years. For most of the 20th century, it had been the state's industrial powerhouse, packed with textile and furniture factories and home to more millionaires per capita than any other city in the nation. But nearly half its jobs went away when the millionaires sent the textile work to Honduras and Mexico in the wake of NAFTA in 1994, and the furniture jobs to China after that. Bill Clinton had predicted that China's 2001 entry into the World Trade Organization would eventually create a win-win for workers. American companies would theoretically be able to export products to China's growing consumer class, an argument Wall Street championed when stock prices climbed with every new plant closing announcement. Corporate shareholders and CEOs ate up Clinton's prediction, a cheery, best-case version of Adam Smith's 18th-century invisible hand. As The Economist described it, Chinese peasants would better their lot by making chairs in factories, while dislocated American workers would retrain for more fulfilling, advanced jobs. But with ill-designed training for displaced Americans based on a lumbering federal program created in the 1960s, the second part of that equation very rarely came to pass. Only a third of workers who qualified for trade adjustment assistance even went back to school, and the majority of those who did found themselves with new certifications and associate's degrees, yet earning much less than they had in the factories if they were working at all. The ones I met who were coping the best worked part-time at Walmart, supplementing their pay with food stamps, food pantry donations, and small vegetable gardens. Consumers all got cheaper jeans, yes, but what did that matter to the people who had once stitched them if they were now out of work and couldn't afford new clothes? The global economy created winners and losers, Bassett Furniture CEO Rob Spilman told me, explaining the dismissal of some 8,000 furniture workers from his payroll. It was that or perish, he said. At the end of the day, we are not a social experiment. In rural counties decimated by globalization, automation, and the decline of coal, the invisible hand manifested in soaring crime, food insecurity, and disability claims. In Martinsville and surrounding Henry County, unemployment rates rose to above 20%, food stamp claims more than tripled, and disability rates went up 60.4%. What those numbers look like on the ground, as I began reporting on the recession in 2008 for the Roanoke Times, and later for my first book, Factory Man, published in 2014, could be distilled in two images I observed but did not fully, at the time, comprehend. The first was of adults, black and white, young and old, arriving at area food pantries 2 hours before the doors open, the older among them clutching canes or leaning on walkers. The second was the smoldering remains of an abandoned furniture factory in the town of Bassett, near Martinsville. An unemployed 34-year-old was attempting to rip out copper electrical wires to resell on the black market when he inadvertently sparked a fire that burned the shuttered factory down. In his police mugshot, you could see the burns on his face. It was easy to understand the connection between joblessness and hunger, to get that hunger fueled some of the crime. It was growing clearer, too, that the federal disability program was becoming a de facto safety net for the formerly employed, a well-intentioned but ultimately disastrous way of incentivizing poor people to stay sick with mental illness and chronic pain, conditions that are hard to prove and frequently associated with mental health and substance use disorders, prompting the majority of disability awards. That same pattern was playing out in the Lee County coal fields, where some parents coaxed their children's doctors toward ADHD diagnoses, knowing that such behavioral problems could help make them eligible for Social Security disability when they became adults. One Lee County healthcare manager told me, "Ritalin is a pipeline to disability here," describing the federal program as a coping mechanism for poverty and workplace uncertainties. A hospital administrator I know from nearby eastern Kentucky recalled a drug abuse resistance education officer asking her high school classmates what they wanted to be when they grew up. "A drawer," one man said. "You mean an artist?" "No, a drawer." someone who draws disability checks. It was the only avenue he could imagine for himself, the only way to get himself and his family fed. Well over half of Lee County's working-age men